which I was absolutely scathing. They had no what we call standing operating procedures. There was no set way that a report was made out, so I had all the papers at the end of the exercise to analyze myself. Mm-hmm. Different countries would report the same stock with a different number, things like that. You know, all these, what do they call it, jet fuels 1 and 2 and all that kind of rubbish. And they had different phrases. There wasn't any standard way of doing anything.
You know, it's funny. It seems that from the inception of NATO, that was one of the key goals.
Well, you would have thought so. But these civilian committees that were running things had no knowledge of this kind of thing at all. They failed to take action on some of these things that I threw at them. Mm-hmm. And they made a lot of gross mistakes in compiling the reports and that kind of thing. Didn't add up numbers right and things like that. Mm-hmm. They sent a staff in. They assembled a staff from these various countries to come in and help at the headquarters, you see, for it. Mm-hmm. And their own secretary was there trying to help them too, but he was on the being exercised, not helping me at all, you see. Mm-hmm. Their secretary of that committee. Well, I really wrote out a very, very... I thought it was all extremely factual, and there was no sarcasm in it. It was just what I felt was wrong with the exercise and what the exercise had shown.
And was it sent to Chippico, or was it sent to Lord...
Well, I sent it to Coleridge, Lord Coleridge, and I sent a copy to Chippico, and I sent copies to a lot of people. I think I sent one to each country that was represented, you see. Mm-hmm. Each member on the committee. I sent a lot of copies out, I remember that. But Beaumont, he was a Dutchman who was the secretary of the Air Transport Committee. And he and I shared the same office. Mm-hmm. He's a pretty good fellow to get on with. I never had any problem with him. But when I was working on this, I was telling him about some of these things. He said, "Oh my gosh, man," he said, "Thorley will crucify you." He said, "He'll get you fired." Well, I didn't care whether you were fired or not. Well,
how long had you been working there at this time?
Well, this was well on. I'd been there for quite some time.
September, wasn't it?
So when was Barbara and Dick there?
September.
Yeah, well, it was when Barbara and Dick came along. We told them not to come, some friends, not to come in the middle of this exercise. They said, "Oh, that's our time to come to Paris, so we're coming." Mm-hmm. I said, "I'm sorry, I won't see you." But I had a letter from Thorley after the exercise. And far from, I kept it because I thought if I ever saw Beaumont again, I'd like to show it to him. He tell you what a terrific exercise this was, of what great importance it had been to NATO. He said, "With your assistance, it became possible for the first time to test our planning assumptions and methods in connection with NATO exercise. And so on, the valuable lessons learned from this exercise have led to important revisions in our plans." He goes on and on here. And all my friends in NATO are going to miss me and all this kind of thing, because I'd left by then. Mm-hmm. But I was quite surprised to get that from Thorley, who was known as an absolute terror. Mm-hmm. But so I guess I wasn't misappreciated there. But I wouldn't have wanted to face Thorley when he first read it.
Because it would reflect badly upon him, too, I should say.
Oh, it did, indeed. Yeah. Very badly, because he had provided some of the staff from, what was it? British Petroleum, I think. They were civilians, you see. They weren't even government officials. Mm-hmm. And I gave them more criticism than anybody else, because they sat around doing nothing. Yeah. So much for that. The overall exercise planning went along fairly... Oh, it was made some progress, but it was very slow. Mm-hmm. And I got nowhere with the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. All Americans, they're American leaders. But there was, I worked this out, that there were to be the annual NATO military training conference. And this year it took place in Norfolk, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And every country sent a representative to it. And I remember there was a general from France, I can't remember any of the others, but I asked to have a time to give a presentation at this thing. Got it. I think I only asked for 40 minutes or whatever it was. So we flew over there, and for this exercise, which was getting close to the time I was leaving, to this meeting on exercises, it was to plan the next year's overall NATO exercises and on the military side. And when we went there, it was rather amusing. There was this French general, who I forget his name, but he'd taken some time to study English. And he said to me, I was the only Anglo-Saxon flying over there on the same plane as he was. Mm-hmm. So he said to me, now, you help me with my English when we go over there. He said, you stick close by and help me. He said, I'll try and use it. You help me. Well, really, it was humiliating. We got off the plane in the States. He said, now, we have to confirm these return flights, don't we, kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah. I said, I'll do that for you, General, right now. He said, oh, no, I want you, let me do it. He said, but you stick close by me, you see. So he went up to the wicket. I would like to confirm this return flight, you see. Girl behind the wicket says, you betcha. That's the way it went the whole damn time. This poor guy, he gave up. He's all pretty.
You betcha.
Oh, dear. We're terrible when it comes to that, you know.
Mm.
Dealing with a foreigner, you'd think people have a little bit more consideration, but they don't.
Yeah, I think they only appreciate it when they themselves are foreigners.
Yeah, that's right.
Country.
That's right.
And even then, they expect the foreigner to speak English,
yeah. Well, when I got there, there was an admiral, vice admiral, greeted us, and the conference was to start the next day. Mm-hmm. And he gave some opening remarks and so on, and then he said, here's a copy of the agenda of the conference, which was about a three-day affair.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it quickly, and I was the last person on the agenda to have time for a presentation.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to him, and after the little ceremony they had there, I said to him, Admiral, I'm very, very disturbed about this. I said, I have a proposition I want to make to you, which I consider is very important to this conference. And I said, I think I ought to come early on the agenda so there's a time for it to be thought out before you have to come to a decision. Ah. And I said, therefore, I would like to be put earlier on the agenda so I can get an answer by the time I leave the thing. Well, he said, I'll see what I can do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the next day they had an amendment to it and put me on the first day. And I gave them my pitch, which was, I thought this out for months because I didn't know what to do about it. I gave them my pitch that, well, did they really want this to go up to council and have it explained to NATO council how totally divergent their attitude to war was?
Mm-hmm.
If that's what they wanted, then I was certainly going to have to present it to them. And I said, on the other hand, I said, if you can come to some kind of an agreement on what period of time these committees and activities should begin to commence and so on, when they're going to be required, then we'll be able to run our exercise to everybody's satisfaction. Well, at the end of the conference, there were always three senior American officers there. They came up with it, and everybody had heard my presentation, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And they came up with it, and they said, well, we think it should be agreed that 30 days is the answer. So the Air Force and the Navy had given in, and I won my point.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I was right ready. I flew back to Paris. I put the thing through Tipico's committee very quickly. I did this big screed on how the exercise should all be done and so on. I hadn't finished out a lot of it, but the basics of the approval for it and so on needed to be done, and I had this all worked out. I rushed it through Tipico's committee, and then it was rushed into the council itself, which I attended when I had to speak on it when it was put up,
mm-hmm.
and it was rapidly approved there. But
So after all these months of finagling, you were able to get it through?
I got it through. I got the thing through with everything I wanted.
But that was an example of it not going through the committee, but going through and
getting it on your own. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was what I did anyway. But one of the rather annoying things was that just before I went to Norfolk,
mm-hmm.
and had all this in plans in mind, I got a notice from Ottawa saying I was to be posted back to Canada. and I would have had to leave Paris before I would went to Norfolk. So I wired back to them and said, told them what the score was, and this, and that my job would be over in about another 2 weeks, but couldn't I keep me on the job until then?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer came back, and it said, well, you can stay on as long as you want, but I was to be promoted to a brigadier, you see,
mm-hmm.
but you won't be promoted until you get back to Canada. So it was going to cost me 2 weeks promotion time, you see, service time. So I had to take leave. I had to take 2 weeks leave in order to do all that final business so that I wouldn't be posted back to Canada. So I applied for leave, and I went to Norfolk on leave, kind of thing.
Right.
Not at my expense, but as far as Canada was concerned, I was on leave.
Well, tell me, was the posting that vital that you had to get back to Canada immediately?
Not at all. No,
so simply had a case of them saying, do it
well,
now.
Well, that's it, yeah. Ottawa being autocratic, that's all. But it was rather annoying at the time, me, but I've managed to get everything through the way I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It one thing that was rather amusing to me, it might be interested in it, and that is when I was on survival, I asked for a course which was being run in Montreal by an American on what was called clear technical writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I put it up to Wrench. Wrench said, looked at it, it was going to cost, what, $50 a day. He said, look, I'll take it to, what was his name, Deputy Minister? Elgin Armstrong. He said, I'll take it to him, but he said, if he turns it down, I won't argue with him. But by golly, it was approved.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this darn good course. Well, this is, I don't know whether you're familiar with it, I forget his name. But the way you do it is you analyze your sentences on the basis of the number of multisyllabic words in it. Then, depending on the average, you divide it by the number of words in the sentence,
mm-hmm.
and then you also work, I think, on the number of clauses in it and so on. And then you, if you're using this system, you then take the sentence apart and if you're saying, whereas I usually do so-and-so on Mondays, this week I think I might do so-and-so, or on the other hand, I might do so-and-so and so-and-so. You can take that all apart and just say, sometimes I do so-and-so, other times I do so-and-so. You see, and cut it down, and you reduce this down to Hemingway's type of...
very sparse.
And you avoid the multisyllabic words. You can almost always find a couple of simple words that'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they have it all worked out, or this fellow had. It's all worked out on the basis of your educational background is able to handle a certain what they call fog index in this, and by counting this all up, you do it all mathematically, you see, and once you've done it for every sentence in the whole thing, presumably, you then work it out as to what fog index there is there, and even a university graduate has a relatively you're either low or high fog index in that you have to, many articles you pick up in the press or say, I forget the numbers, say a fog index of 21 or something like that,
mm-hmm.
not in the press but in technical language, and the average for a university graduate is something like 5, you see,
mm-hmm.
and the theory is that by the time you figure out in the back of your mind how these clauses are interrelated and so on, you've lost the theme of what's going on. And in any event, I always had a lot of use for this thing. I've tried it many times.
Was it for you or was it for your staff?
Oh, no, just for me.
Mm-hmm.
And but when I'd written up this great screed on how the NATO exercise should be run, it was all written. I was just hoping to get the final approval there at Norfolk, which I did. But I went over the whole darn thing, and I worked out all the sentences and everything on the basis of the fog index.
Mm-hmm.
And I would change them around and worked. I had about a week or so. That's all I did,
mm-hmm.
the whole time. I was finished as far as I was concerned. I was just waiting for North. Well, I worked this thing over, and I was pretty darn proud of it myself, but it certainly didn't match NATO language at all with their grandiose phraseology. And you know, they would say instead of buy, they'd say take on inventory and things like that. You know how the kind of talker is. It's just a gobbledygook.
Well, the idea is to blow, you know, make it more important.
Well, that's it. Sure. Well, the amusing part of this to me was that I once had a look in the window of the guy's office who ran the central typing pool, not our own that we had, which only had a few girls in it, but there was a central typing pool. When you wanted a big thing typed, it had to go down there and be done, you see. Our own girls only just did letters and things like that. I never had any trouble because I knew my timetable, and I wasn't always running down there at the last minute asking for a 30-page thing to be typed by tomorrow morning or something, you see. Mm-hmm. Everybody else on the staff used to complain bitterly about the way they couldn't get things typed, but they weren't giving them a chance, you know. Mm-hmm. I never had any problem, but I always had my stuff typed on time. But the fellow who ran this typing pool was known to be the most awful tyrant. He was a British officer. I think he was a second secretary or something like that. And I just looked in the window one time and saw this mass of girls in there all typing and charts up and people running around, orderlies carrying buckets of paper and this kind of thing. Holy smoke, what an awful thing to have to run, you see.
A real sweatshop.
Real sweatshop. And terribly complicated. Oh, everybody wanted something typed. Mm-hmm. By golly, he came up to see me after I'd submitted this for typing. He came up to see me. The whole staff was absolutely flabbergasted. He'd never come to see anybody before. And he sat down, and he said, "I just wanted to meet you." I said, "Oh, holy smoke, he isn't going to type my thing or something." And he said, "Do you know," he said, "I've been here, I forget how many years, in this job in NATO." And he said, "All the big papers going up to council." He said, "I always read myself." He said, "It's the first paper I've ever seen that I understood." He said, "I wanted to meet the person who'd written it." Well, I don't wonder because some of the papers there, it was terribly hard to understand.
Yes.
Well, I think I can end this off pretty rapidly by simply saying that also towards the end of my period there, there was the Cuban crisis.
Really?
Yes. When Kennedy had to kick Khrushchev out of Cuba, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there was... NATO was, the civil staff where I was in pandemonium. Almost every country there, I was the only one who stood up for the Americans throughout any of the arguments we had. They were saying, "Oh, the Americans just can't do this, stop shipping on the high seas and so on to search Soviet ships, you know. Just can't do it, this is ridiculous, and so on and so on. Well, they're going to get us into a war or something, you see, and so on." Well, I used to argue, I said, "Look, if the Soviets put their short-range missiles into Cuba, that means that Washington is under direct threat. Do you want to see that?" I said, "How can you expect any American president to accept that situation? Don't be silly, you see."
Mm-hmm.
Boy, they didn't like that at all. But when Kennedy won and they had to withdraw it, I think myself, and I heard since the guy who replaced me, that they pulled the whole rug out from under civil emergency, because all these countries then said, "Oh, well, the Americans can solve the problem anytime they want. They'll just threaten the Russians, you see."
Mm-hmm.
And McNamara, who was then the Minister of Defense, Secretary of Defense in the United States, decided that he had had civil defense under his control.
Mm-hmm.
I think when he first arrived there, when the first missile crisis came along. But he decided that civil defense was not a very important thing from then on. So I think the whole thing generally faded from...
Well, at that period, we're also looking at the end of the Khrushchev period, the beginning of Brezhnev and detente taking place, where you didn't have the confrontational attitude between the Soviets and the Americans.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
The entire Cold War de-escalated.
It de-escalated right away, right after the Cuban affair.
Well, the Americans were concerned with Vietnam.
Oh, yeah. But that
I
didn't.
I think the Russians were concerned with China at that point.
Yes, yes. But it tended to, survival as such, tended to sort of fade out.
Mm-hmm.
And... as you said, I happened to hit some of these things when the iron was hot, and that was one of them. And I enjoyed the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
We did an awful lot of traveling.
So did I.
Every weekend, we would go and travel around the countryside, but for once in my life, I never took any documents home.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it was a place to do that.
And they had fabulous hours.
Oh, yeah.
Lunch hour.
We had 2 hours off for lunch.
All staff?
Yeah. They started, what time did we start in the morning?
I started at 7, but I'm I'm not sure.
Oh, I think it was more like 8 o'clock in the morning. We knocked off at 12 and came back at 2. And then we knocked off at 7.
Yeah.
That's what the hours were.
So
but in the 2 hours, in the lunch hour,
mm-hmm.
we could meet anywhere in Paris using the underground. Mm-hmm. And I would snatch a hamburger or something in our canteen. And she wouldn't have eaten. A jambon, yeah. But then we could go and meet and go through a museum or something like that in the lunch hour.
Mm-hmm.
We'd do this every day if we wanted. It worked out extremely well.
And would the NATO offices be close to the downtown or in the downtown?
They were pretty close,
But you can go anywhere in Paris in 20 minutes in the underground, or you could there, so it didn't matter where. You can go all over in the metro. We used it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I had a car, but Jesus, terrible driving in Paris. You could tear around in the metro. So we did that, and weekends we went all over France, didn't we?
Yeah.
And we had a duty trip to Italy, and that was marvelous. And I drove down, had to take leave.
Mm-hmm.
NATO insisted that you go by air, unless you did it on leave. You could get your airfare paid, but not anything else, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So, I got the equivalent of my airfare, you see. But I just took a little bit of extra leave and drove down to Italy to the conference there was there to attend. And then we drove back again for Christmas.
In our little Peugeot.
And your kids were in England, I take it. Would they come over for holidays with you? Or?
Yes.
Yeah, they did. We did one tour of a week in Easter around the Chateau of the Loire.
Really?
Oh, it was marvelous.
We went to all those places that just were in the,
Normandy?
Oh, yeah, all along the Normandy coast, yeah. Went and visited those. Went and saw the Bayou Tapestry. Practically every weekend, so it didn't work on Saturday and Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So we went all over. Oh, yeah. Then we went up trips to Germany. And finally...
To the Hague we took.
Well, that was a duty trip.
Well, we went to the Hague again and took train, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. That must have been another trip. We did a lot of them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, on a weekend, you can go a long way in Europe.
Yes. Would you go by train or would you always go by car?
No, car. All those were by car.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I went to England and that, I'd fly, but it was, we had a marvelous time to look around. Then one of my daughters decided she didn't, her oldest decided she didn't want to go to prep school again.
How old was she at this time?
What would she be then?
Oh.
16 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And, I wanted to send her to a secretarial college, but she didn't want to go, so she wanted to go back to Canada. So we went over to England for August and put her on the boat going back to Canada. And then we took the youngest and did a tour up to Scotland and all over the place with her,
mm-hmm.
with our little Peugeot. So we had quite a lot of traveling on that posting, too. Yeah.
Did that rather compensate for the fact that you were dealing with it, you know, working, doing a job that was rather frustrating? Because I assume that's what it was like.
Well, it was frustrating. I didn't mind it. I wouldn't have said at any time I was totally frustrated. I just felt that in a year I should have made a lot more progress than that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you knew what you were dealing with, I really couldn't feel ashamed of myself. I didn't feel anybody could have... sparked the thing up at all.
Well, that is one of the biggest problems of any sort of multinational
grouping.
I mean,
terrible.
Speed is not what one can accomplish.
Oh, terrible. I learned a lot about parliamentary procedure because they used to run their meetings on basically on Robert's Rules of Order.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, there were some real, sorry, what we call in the Army barrack room lawyers in there. By golly, they'd argue over those things.
And they'd quote line and verse, probably.
Yeah, they could, yeah. And most of these people who attended a lot of these meetings were government officials, civil servants and so on, you know, from their own country. And they'd come in for this meeting, and they would use the most devious kind of methods that, for example, one of the simplest is that you... The subject is under consideration. And they'll ask to speak. You see, I get the chairman's attention. They ask to speak. And then they start out on that subject, and then halfway through they switch on to another subject that they're more interested in, or trying to draw everybody off the trail, you see.
Yeah.
Well, naturally, the chairman should immediately say, well, now, you can raise that at a second time. We're now discussing so-and-so. Mm-hmm. But our chairman weren't all, some of them weren't all that good either. And, but they're very often an American, where the Americans were sharp when they attended things like that. They were all civilians. They'd say, Mr. Chairman, I object. He's changing the subject. You know, this kind of thing, oh boy, there's some real arguments go on there.
Oh, you bet, especially if it's a Frenchman who's trying to change the argument.
Oh, yeah, the French are, oh, geez. Well, of course, NATO was, or France, well, France was still in NATO at the time.
Mm-hmm. Had it changed perceptibly when de Gaulle had taken over, though?
Oh, very much so. Now, when we were in Yugoslavia, there was the last French assistant military attaché there was a fellow by the name of De La Rancière. I think he was a major at that time, wasn't he? But when I got to Paris again, this was later, I heard that he was on the staff or saw him in a telephone book or something. And he was de Gaulle's personal representative at SHAPE. And everything that was considered at SHAPE had to be shown to him. Mm-hmm. Now, no other head of state had that kind of responsibility. And everybody thought this was a, you know, well, most people said, well, it was a silly condescension to de Gaulle to allow him to put that on. I said, I'm going to go and see De La Rancière, call on him, you see. So I did. I went and called on him. And although we'd been great friends before, it was obviously the chill was on. There was no real question. You couldn't be a friend with him anymore. And he made it quite plain that...
With the door shut and no one else around?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He just said, well, I have a job to do here and kind of thing and so on. I tried to get him to tell me what his job was and that, but he was very cold. Mm-hmm. And I think he felt, well, he knew me too, and he didn't want me prodding around his what he was there for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually rather good to hear that someone took his job so seriously that he would protect it.
Well, that... Of course, this was a terrible time because this was when what were those people in Algeria, you know, that were blowing up?
The OAS?
OAS, or what was it?
Bombs
going off. You'd hear them going off all over Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And the police would suddenly descend on a street, block off both ends, and everybody in the street gets searched for everything and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They had thousands of policemen there. It was a very difficult time.
Mm-hmm. And the thing was, these were all Frenchmen who were doing it, and quite often ex-Legionnaires who were doing it.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they were the couple of Legionnaire generals had been behind
it
all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we just, you know, read about it in the press every day.
Indeed, it was a period when de Gaulle was actually not necessarily liquidating, but certainly purging his system of these kind of officers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very much so. I think, well, wasn't it while we were there that he was, the attempt that was made to assassinate him on his way down to Rambouillet. Remember they machine gunned his car. His car and so on.
I think so. Yeah.
I think it was while we were there.
And
yeah.
The fellow was actually shot or guillotined or something. And that's what Frederick Forsyth based his novel around.
Oh?
Yeah.
Which one was that?
The Day of the Jackal.
Yeah.
I've got it.
It's good.
I've seen the movie about three times.
Hoping each time you'd get him. It's a dreadful thing to say, but... Another few seconds more, you know.
Yeah, well... I thought it was a pretty good movie, really. As movies go, not necessarily factual.
But it held your interest, it was plausible,
and
it was intelligently made, and it's not made for a sap. It's
not
one of these teeny bopper films, you know.
No. Oh, how true.
Yeah.
Well, except I didn't see how he would happen to find a garage that he could work on his car.
No, I thought there was an awful lot of that was a little bit fanciful.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, too, there were a lot of things like this, that when he'd fitted this telescopic sight to this rifle he had,
mm-hmm.
and he went out in the woods by himself to try it on a target. And he didn't look around to see whether anybody was watching him, as anybody in real life would have. He just went up there, put up the jacket, bing, 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 turned around, walked, and never looked around at anything, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, this made silence around it, didn't he? So there was no noise.
Did. No, but if I were doing it, I'd have eyes all over my head. Mm-hmm. I thought a lot of those things were a bit fanciful, but nevertheless, if you're going to make a movie, you can't make it too detailed.
Yeah. Yeah. The Israelis perhaps have captured Carlos?
Yes.
That could be quite a thing.
Yeah.
As well, I don't know if you read the paper this morning or not, but it seems that the Soviets have resurrected old Molotov.
Yeah.
At the age of 94.
Yes, 94.
Good Lord.
I didn't know he was still living.
Well,
it's the only... The only, as far as I'm concerned, it's the only major concession I've seen to Stalinism.
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of think that they're trying to groom him as a new leader. I mean, that's Chernenko goes.
Who?
Molotov. He's at the right age.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's at the right age, all right. It's either that or make him a pope or something.
Indeed. But 94, my goodness.
94. What a character.
General Hicks,
wasn't it? 94? Yeah,
yeah. Fantastic. I mean, he was pretty healthy and well up until a couple of years ago, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
General
Hicks.
I mean, I guess he wasn't so well
during
the last couple of years.
About a year ago, I think he had a bad case of pneumonia or something,
yeah.
And
yeah.
He almost died then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you know the Hicks?
Yeah.
Mrs.
Hicks
and
yeah.
John.
She got to know her then. Yeah, I met Perk several times here and talked to him briefly.
Oh, he always knew you, didn't he?
Yeah.
You never had to say who.
No, I didn't. But never had any serious discussions with him. Mainly it was at Conservative Affairs that I met him.
Are you active in the Conservative Party?
I was. Not now.
Do you still support the Conservatives?
Yeah,
I dislike the Liberals so much. I can't quite say I'd vote NDP, but if I thought that would keep the Liberals out, I would.
There's always a rhinoceros party, you know.
Yeah.
I did see the Gallup poll in this morning's paper the Liberals at 49, the Conservatives,
yeah.
I think, 38.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's I still have hopes.
Now, the Green Party does interest me. It seems in the last platform, one of their major... one of the major planks of it was to get the people to grow potatoes, which I think is a great idea.
Yeah.
That was one of their main ideas.
Yeah.
That and saving whales, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I campaigned, you know, vigorously by going around doorbell ringing. We did together for a couple of elections, but... I eventually felt that I was too dated for it all.
Mm-hmm.
There were an awful lot, there were people my own age, there was no use talking to them, because their mind had been made up, but a lot of the younger people, I don't think, felt that they needed any advice. They were making up their own mind. And they don't look to the elder generation
for guidance.
For any guidance, I don't think. So I just felt, well, it's somebody younger should be doing this.
And we knew Don Monroe in Laos.
Oh, yeah, we knew Don Monroe in Laos when he was the High Commissioner there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he had a party for us, didn't he?
Did you and do you like him?
Oh, yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
I was going to say that you and he are, I would think, roughly the same age, same generation at least.
Yeah, I guess so.
So,
I've
no reason to say that you're outdated. You know, in the same breath, you'd say that he's outdated.
Well, just felt that the younger generation... was thinking that whether they vote, which way they vote, I don't know, but no, I wouldn't say he's outdated at all.
Not at all, no. Did you have given any thought for yourself, running or doing
anything
like that?
No, never.
Don Monroe has really worked very hard, and I don't think a lot of it has ever been noticed.
I was terribly disappointed that he didn't at least get the job of the external affairs critic this last time. I think his background entitled him to something a good deal more than what he got, which was nothing.
Well, indeed, under the Clark regime for the 9 months, it was widely rumored that he would get a cabinet post because
he didn't.
Was one of the few who really supported Clark.
Yeah,
And he didn't. And I think I think that since they allocated the defense portfolio to McKinnon,
yeah.
They felt that two island portfolios would be too much.
That's it. Very hard to make up a cabinet in Canada. But when they put, what's his name, the fellow who voted for Joe Clark and swung everything over and gave in to him, Sinclair Stevens, he's now the foreign affairs critic for Mulroney. Well, I don't think Sinclair Stevens knows anything about being foreign affairs.
But his position within the party is such that he gets a prestige post.
So I wouldn't. Don Monroe, you know, had decided not to run again.
I think some Pat Crofton.
Yeah, we know him too, of course.
What is he like?
Young fellow. He's a, well, I say young, ex naval. Very good chap, as far as I know. Is he?
I think I saw Crofton at Sydney Days. They had a.
Oh, yeah.
The Sydney blocked off, and they had the different. They had Jerry Christensen of the Liberal Party, and they had the NDP candidate down there, and they were all lobbying down there.
Oh, yeah.
And it was rather disappointing that the Liberal candidate is the same one that's lost the last two elections. I mean, they just keep running him and running him.
Is, what's his name, Christensen? Is he running again?
Yeah.
I thought I heard something about Wally Dutemple was going to run, but I don't know.
I thought he said he was going to.
Who's Walter Dutemple?
Dutemple, he's the guy that runs the
Ardmore
Golf Course down here.
Really? What persuasion is he? Liberal?
He's liberal.
Yeah. But I don't know what happened. I just sort of heard rumors about it, and somebody said that he had gone up to them and said, I'm your new Liberal candidate. But then his name has faded away.
I didn't even hear of the Liberal Party even having a candidate's nomination committee or anything. It was just Jerry Christensen was it.
No, I don't. I agree with you. I didn't hear that at all.
I suppose they felt that since there's so little power in the riding for the Liberals, that might as well stick with someone the public seems to know, even though he's lost the last two elections.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't think they've ever done well in this riding.
David Anderson, who was here,
we also knew.
He won it for the Liberals in, when Trudeau got elected.
In 68?
First time, yeah. And we know David Anderson very well. He was in Vietnam with me.
And what was your opinion of him?
Well, we used to call him Senator Foghorn.
Had he retained that nickname when you met him next? Out here?
I don't think we ever met him again.
Mm-hmm.
No, didn't. Well, he was the legal advisor on the Canadian delegation, and really hadn't qualified as a lawyer then.
Good God!
But why kind of had him listed as a legal on the legal committee? I don't know why they did. I guess it was his liberal pull, you see.
Either that or if they couldn't find a lawyer who wanted to go.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. That might have been it.
And then next he went to China.
Yeah, then he went. What did he do in China?
Taking languages.
Language course. From external affairs. We sent him to China for a year. And the next thing he showed up here, didn't he? And ran for the Liberal Party. Got elected.
I don't think he did much for external affairs with his Chinese.
I don't think he did, no.
What a waste of government money.
Yeah.
Oh, terrible.
Frightful.
I mean, aside from his salary, which they'd have to pay all his expenses.
Yeah. Oh, all his expenses. Here, all his fare out there and back and so on.
I guess that's the problem with the Liberal government. And has been the problem.
Yeah.
Patronage and...
Yeah.
Patronage is just disgraceful.
It is really.
That's my English.
Have you got your machine running?
No, but I'm going to turn her off right now.